Tune to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Free Speech Radio News airs every Friday at 5 p.m. on Weft Community Radio, followed by Smile Politely Radio coming up next. This will be our last edition of Smile Politely Radio in the foreseeable future, so we will be switching to a new show in coming weeks. Stay with us after that for RBN Hip Hop at 6 p.m., followed by Blues Live at 8 and The Bachelor Pad featuring lounge music and Exotica at 10 p.m. And now for this week's last edition of Smile Politely Radio.
You are listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local: arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, tech, and more. This week's Smile Politely Radio features creative writers who read recently in The Reading Room. The Reading Room takes place at the Accord in downtown Champaign. We'll first hear fiction from Roya Katablu.
This piece is called Live. I've parked here I don't know how many times since I moved into this apartment, so I don't understand why I'm only seeing this note now. My car is almost always in one of the few spots off the street right beside the building. It's been raining. The Post-it is encased in a sandwich baggie, soggy and forlorn-looking, tucked under my windshield wiper. In all angry caps it reads, "If you do not actually live here, please park your car on the street." Anger blooms inside me, and I stalk up the stairs to my apartment, scowl into the hallway, and shut the door. I make a cup of tea. It's not just the drink that soothes me, but the ritual surrounding it, the clank of the teapot onto my rickety 50s stove, the click and rush it makes when lit, waiting patiently for its shriek. I do all of this as if in a trance, the whole time thinking of a rebuttal. I decide not to respond right away. Alone in my apartment, I sit at the table under my skylight and read scraps of internet news about the political implications of the filtering of Syrian refugees into Jordan, the splitting of factions in Mali. I try for perspective. I answer emails and receive quick replies and then answer them again. I lie on my back on the couch reading until I feel that familiar throb and ache that always comes from anger, and when I touch myself, I turn my face from the lamp as if even alone I don't want to do it with the lights on. While my mind plays scenes out, I try to focus on bodies. I try not to picture a particular face. Later I imagine who might have left it, going from apartment to apartment in my mind, peeking through the cracks of the doors I see them enter. The woman with the baby that never seems to grow, who she takes for walks in a large plush stroller she leaves in the lobby below rather than carry it up to the third floor. There's the bike messenger and his girlfriend on the floor below me. They laugh loudly at the television and fight quietly with strained voices, their wine and timber leaking through the vents into my apartment like the filtering of marijuana smoke. Then the man and his dog, who play on the lawn outside the building. Awkwardly, I say hello to them when coming home. Sometimes I see a single woman, dowdy in khaki pants and snow boots, with wide hips and a sturdy gait, pushing into her apartment on the ground floor. Once I had a package left on the porch, and I found it moved just inside our locking outer door with a note that said her name, but I can't remember it. I can't imagine who would have left it, or why they couldn't simply ask whose car it is. I have a door they could knock on. I can invite them in, give them a cup of chamomile and maybe a slice of apple cake, and we could talk about ourselves and the neighbors and the way our landlord will never get rid of those raccoons. Perhaps the tea would grow cold in our cups while we talked, and I would brew another pot, remark how it never stays warm because I don't have a cozy, but maybe they would like another slice of cake while we wait. Maybe the light would grow golden outside the windows and reflect on my hair in that way I'm told makes it look reddish and my skin look plump with life. And we would both jump at the kettle shriek and laugh at ourselves. Lying in bed that night, I think about the injustice of it. I imagine knowing who wrote it, standing indignant in the hallway, telling them they could have just asked me, they could have just made an effort to know. I think about all the times I've stood in that parking space, shoveling snow from under my tires, scraping ice from the windshield as my wrists ached with cold and effort and my nose ran. I think about all the times they could have handed me my mail when it had been put in the wrong box instead of leaving it on the carpet outside my door, and how they could say hello when they passed me in the hallway. They must know me. They have to know my face by now. As I lie there, it feels unusually hot in my bed, the itchiness of my flannel pajamas chafing at my neck and the tender parts of my inner arms. I lie awake until about 1 a.m. when I finally throw off the covers and put on a pair of wool socks. then my snow boots, tucking the flannel bottoms in so I don't have to go to bed with soggy ankles. I put my down coat over my pajamas, take out the note, turn it over, and write one of my own. I slip it back in the plastic. The rubber soles of my boots cushion my steps down the hallway. No sound comes from any apartment. Outside, the air is crisp and breath balloons from my nostrils, dissipating into the still, silent air. The rain has turned to snow. Down the street, lamps pour their glow onto the falling powder and hold it there, each moment a picture, each breath a fog that disturbs the view. I try not to breathe. Far away, I hear the passing of a car on the main road, and I exhale, feel the pull of some other person moving away from me in the dark. I walk to my car. The snow barely whispers beneath my shoes. The windshield wiper is stiff with ice, but I manage to slip the note under it. I live here, back off, declaring itself into the night. The next morning when I go to my car, the note is gone, and so is the snow. I wonder if I really put it there, if my bravery was simply a dream that propelled me, a comfort that delivered me through the dark and out onto the other side. As I stand next to my car, I look up and down the road. A young woman in a long wool coat watches her beagle urinate into a rock garden. An old man retrieves the newspaper from a bush. It's a bright, cold day. I look up at my apartment building, and it looks so peaceful, I wonder if I ever saw the note at all. But I break through this dreaminess and look around at the other cars, wondering which belongs to the person who wrote it. I live here. I do. And now they know this. But still, I think, as I creak open the driver's side door, maybe they mean something by actually. I actually live here. But I guess it depends on what you mean by here. And I guess it depends on what you mean by live.
And now I'm joined by Matthew Murray. Matthew read recently at the Reading Room at the Accord.
All right. Well, thank you. I have lived in Urbana for a number of years, and I have two grown sons, and they weren't always grown. And this is a poem about something I did with one of my sons. And it's called Donuts. Last night, as temperatures spiraled toward zero and winds swirled snow, my thoughts circled back a few years to a night in Minneapolis when I did donuts with my little son. It was in January, in an empty parking lot covered with snow. In our old black Volvo, I turned to my son and said, "Are you buckled in? Here we go." Under cones of yellow-orange light, I turned the wheel and hit the gas. We slid blurry circles across the night orange snow, laughing and yelling, "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" Sometimes you want to give it a whirl, put all the chips on red, or be a big zero, a no-show when 8 a.m. rolls around for work or school. The world is always turning. I put my foot down and turned the wheel hard. A dozen loose and useless circles in the dark. This is a little different poem, but with both my sons involved in it, and it's called Fireflies. Night falls dark as new blue denim, and fireflies dot the yard with yellow-green sparks. They're seeking mates, but my boys are watching too, hunt them with tennis rackets. The two of them chase and swing at every blink of light they see. When they hit one, it falls in small glowing streaks, like a little plane shot down, like a dim shooting star. I remember killing dragonflies with a stick, slicing them in midair, cutting them to pieces where they landed. I remember shooting ants with rubber bands and nailing crabs with shells at low tide. But now, I hate killing anything, even cockroaches. I hate fishing, the way the worm twists and lashes when I stick the tip of the hook up and into its gooey, boneless body. The way the fish stares in silence as I tear the barb out of its mouth. I'd rather let every living thing live. I'd rather be like the fireflies, all light and desire, turning and flashing midair. Blink, blink, blink. Well, it's kind of interesting. I work in a school library, and my partner works at a public library. And this poem is set in a library. Child sobbing at the library. Suddenly, the quiet, that empty jug, is being filled with crying. A child is sobbing, not the wailing of a slapped kid, and not the tearful screeching of demands and whining. No, it is a child crying for something lost or broken, something that will never be replaced. I listen, loving the sound, as I love a lone violin or muted trumpet slowly filling the bowl of silence. It is the crying that I've lost and will never have again. I want that child to cry and cry for everything I've lost, every love I've squandered, everything I should have done. Cry for my deaf father sitting hunched in front of his loud TV, for the house on Kenmore Street, for the tea we drank falling in love, for the novels I'll never read, for the great paintings hanging unseen all night in empty museums, for the cities of the world, all their joyful streets, all their terrors, for the dead and the way time shoves us along, ignoring every protest. Cry, child, and let it be the song trapped beneath this flat bone here where my ribs come together. Well, it wouldn't be right to read some poems without including something sort of Midwestern. So this one is Skies. Be generous with fiery purple endings and the delicate, elegant glitter of stars. Beneath sky lies harder sky, fields of corn and beans to the far edge of everywhere. Long gone are heavens of high grass, starry with yellow, purple, pink, and white. And sometimes I've glimpsed it in a coyote sprinting in, then out of the headlights, or in a deer midair leaping a fence before disappearing into the trees. That third sky, the one wanting answers. Where are you going? And just who do you think you are? Well, I'll finish up with one about not getting old, but just as one lives through life and things happen to you, it can be a little ominous. I unexpectedly had a bout of anemia that lasted for about a year, and they never figured out what it was. So this one is called Iron. How strange to run out of iron. To fill up with yawn. A finger prick beads blood not so red, not so thick. How strange to sit in the cancer chair and not have cancer. To lose an hour watching a tube infuse a pouch of coffee brown solution into the back of my needled hand until the sac was shriveled. My avatar. Done, my vein looked the same, and I'd felt no pain sitting there, daydreaming of blood, bridles, needles, true north, and the slow triumph of rust.
And now we'll hear fiction by Mary Timmons.
What follows is chapter 2 from part 2 of my novel, The Money Took the Form of. The money took the form of a package of perquisites, which package stipulated a signing bonus, stock options, and interest-free loans, whereby to finance his newest low white car and his newest home, a classically styled contemporary structure of prestigious square footage, walled in white stucco, to which stucco crushed glass had been added, glittering in the sun on sunny days, with views over the bay's blue convexity. on moving from his rooftop apartment into possession of the new home, he immediately invited the pretty young colleague with whom he and C had once motored in his ex-low white car to the upper isthmus, inviting the pretty young colleague to join him at clandestine meetings in the new home, that the pretty young colleague might engage in sexual congress with him at several, Q, lunch hours each working week, and several more, Q, PMs and weekends, engaging throughout the structure at junctures including but not limited to the lower level laundry room, the rare eastern carpet upon the custom hardwood floor of the unfurnished living room, the highly polished and lengthy table in the formal dining room, several, Q, of the bedrooms, the exceptionally large closet off the faux butler's pantry, and the faux butler's pantry itself upon the genuine brick floor in front of the pantry's perpetually clinking ice maker. To his package of perquisites there had accrued a sum unprecedented and indeed indeterminate, plus or minus $XXX capital M, which some embodied and expressed his value to the company as the new officer at its apex, which apex he had gained after coveting it long and in extreme degree. He had gained the apex with the complicity of the boss of finance, now awaiting boosted compensation and exalted responsibilities for this complicity, the boss of finance having leveraged the highly successful initial public offering of company common stock, celebrated some, weeks prior in the hotel ballroom with the opalescent streamers, leveraging the stock for the maximum possible amount that could be borrowed from a range of public and private financial institutions, and diverting the proceeds to banking and investment accounts bearing names of subcompanies, which subcompanies did not exist except as names to which proceeds could be diverted. The boss of finance had then induced the now ex-officer of the company to generate further cash inflow to the company through a new offering of preferred stock valued at $XXXXXXXXX.0, whereupon a dilution, dismayingly predictable in retrospect, had depressed the share price of the common stock initially issued, of which common stock C's valuable benefit was, along with the valuable benefits of all the members of the company at the time of the hotel ballroom party, part. Such dilution was a matter of urgent unease for those seated on the company's board, including the earnest but unfocused son of the company's owner, the owner himself being now ill. Sunken sadly, but not without an ecstatic and even celestial sense of grace and power, into his ill father's ownership seat on the company's board, the earnest but unfocused son set about immediately to eliminate the unease over the dilution heretofore described. He called for the removal, expulsion of the now ex-officer of the company, member of the company since inception, and friend of the owner for life, ending, whose principled leadership and conservative business style was to transform his long-standing success into humiliating removal, expulsion, and reasonably well-compensated exile, and who was shortly also to undergo separation from his subsequent lovely young wife, an ex-model of runway fashions in cities throughout the old world, for which occupation she remained qualified by height and facial inertia. The earnest but unfocused son also called for the removal, expulsion of the boss of finance, a calling for which C's ex-boss's boss himself suggested, sadly, in private conversation, deep in cracked but comfortable leather chairs, in their club, invested atop the upended blockage of downtown, showing the earnest but unfocused son certain papers pertaining to certain banking and investment accounts bearing the names of subcompanies which subcompanies did not exist, and also recommending that the company engage the services of a firm of litigators who could provide assistance in the ensuing removal expulsion of the boss of finance, which assistance they did provide with vicious zeal. Thus did C's ex-boss's boss shortly achieve the apex, which apex he had coveted long and in extreme degree, an extremity heretofore inapparent to others, yet which extremity he had felt while in his exposition, and also in several Q prior and subordinate positions, and indeed from the time of his boyhood, difficult. As the company's new officer, he set about immediately and methodically to again raise the price of the company common stock, with which result has been seen in the chapter foregoing. As the company's new officer, he also set about immediately and methodically to remove, expel all those holding positions on the high crest of the company of status coordinate with his own exposition, as well as those of subordinate status in key positions on the various ridges beneath. It was during this time of removal expulsion that he purchased his new low white car and his new stucco contemporary glittering classically proportioned home. A structure of prestigious square footage, greater than LL000. The new home was yet of a design evincing a certain constriction, a certain narrowness of hallways and staircases and window ledges and closets and even bedrooms, of which bedrooms there remained several, Q, wherein the possibilities of sexual congress had yet to be explored in clandestine meetings with the pretty young colleague. When the pretty young colleague departed, departing the new home abruptly, and hastening thence from the city, and indeed the region, and of whom nothing further will be written now or ever.
And now we're going to hear poetry read by A. Loudermilk.
Trying not to cry in public. Nothing's happened, just work, a long story, money. I've got a doctor's appointment in the morning. Dad called, teased me, how I used to play house in that tree he cut down for firewood. I haven't been in a backyard since running away. I prefer alleys where perfumes crawl and every dumpster's numbered. By daylight I know what casts a shadow at night, and vice versa. But then back when I had religion, I had somewhere to go, a hole to climb up into. Long as I could hold my breath, I was clean as an idiot, peeking at the eclipsed silhouette of a dying lady. Long story short, here's to never crying in public. Not even Liebestrom. Dizzy nothing blue, show your hell-red petticoats to an empty room. Not words I like, not Liebestrom, not flashbulbs, not when the house plants are dying. Only the bell I want, the abortion of its clapper. I watch how bodies go plural, gather each other, limb by stretching limb, how in other houses tremendous fires are banked this way and burned with perambulating anniversary, how boys lounge on futons in the arrangement of gladiolas, and when I walk in on them, their arms reach into sleeves and they never mind the buttons. Was thus okay. Skinny a minute after I got out of the hospital, landed a real job with heels on and a sincerely verbal contract. My lucky break hurts every morning. A bus kneels for my dollar as the mood takes my bloodstream to sing, "See how they run, see how they run." Maybe I'll just quit. Change my name, but don't answer to it. Join a support group and show contempt. Nothing's as bad as could be, nor so good. How can I get on unemployment? I must find out the difference between ringing a bell and making that bell ring for me, even if I have to pay my own ransom. Hex marks the parking lot where I was hit by a car. A nice car, so I got lots of therapy and was thus okay, but I could have been amazing. Don't go sober on me, Jonathan. I'll miss you more than when you go bolting back to the city you love, hot for an aria. Who'll be here, leaning on me, pulling me by the arm into conversations about sex research at maximum occupancy parties? This bar to that bar, I never remember it's cold out. I navigate the edge of your spotlight like a cakewalk. Our winter scarves tied up into a not-so-Windsor knot. Sometimes you pine to be the pretty girl, while I go proper like ladies in old novels. Occasionally we are mistaken for brothers, in line that time for drinks, remember? Headache story. With no weaponry on her, she swears, not even car keys. She set off a metal detector at the airport last summer and fainted. She woke balanced on a folding chair, her legs crossed, and a headache. Security glaring like she's a foreigner. Her doctor assured her nothing in her body could set off anything. He didn't have to put it that way, but he did. She hated to believe him and then hated him. When only the radio turned to static, relieved her headache, and spoons tasted good. Getting to the metal, some ring she swallowed as a girl? Interplanetary tracking device? Shrapnel from past lives? Maybe the tap water. She woke one day with two headaches at the same time, she swears, harmonizing, contracting into a dial tone, then the memory of a dial tone. The end of permanence. Twin to twin, heirs irrelevant, whispering at the dinner table about the end of permanence and luggage with wheels. Father stomps his foot and there is a high drain kind of silence as mother, recently hospitalized, still tasting her anesthetic, looks out the window at a storm-totaled gazebo made bonfire against the dire sky. Moving downstairs up before another big rain breaks the levee, hired men stack furniture never meant for stacking in a sentimental attic. Father at the table is not father like a river. Mother wonders, are they still trying to abolish the penny? The twins ask, who's they? Gladys's of the world. It wasn't me is all I ever say, and sorry, it won't happen next time. My jittering the teacups, my far-sighted ladle. Bad habits, like cramming my apron into my coat pocket and leaving rind on the counter. I never picture myself doing what I'm doing, and that's why I never hear them telling me what to do when. I'm no good with a tray, either. Maybe that's why I fall for the waiters in town, rumored to be truth drug smugglers, who look you in the eye while you tell what you'd like. And you know what I'd like? To be where rumors get started. Maybe even one about me. Surely not her, ladies will say, wondering nonetheless.
Back in the bubble city. At least we're running through it on a Friday. If you're just joining us, welcome, welcome, welcome to the ride, huh? Got some classic jams and foundations of funk and hip-hop all the way. It's the Funky Hip-Hop Radio Show, always every Friday from 6 to 8 on 90.1 FM. WEFT, let's get this.